I'm often accused of being a dreamer, but what people sometimes don't recognize is the dedication and perseverance it took to make my dreams reality.
Howard Baldwin started as a minor league ticket counter and steadily worked his way up, eventually becoming a founding owner in the World Hockey Association, or WHA. Known as the Rebel League, the WHA was responsible for forcing the NHL out of its medieval stupor. In time, the two leagues would come together. Howard would play a crucial role in overseeing that merger in ending hockey's seven-year war. But during those 7 years, the League of the Outlaws put out seven great seasons of hockey. Among the teams, none would match the sustained success of Howard's. Essentially born out of a bluff, his New England Whalers were crowned WHA champions in the league's inaugural season. The Avco World Trophy would be far from the last piece of championship hardware Howard hoisted above his head. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves, because the path to that historic night in 1973, the entire path Howard took, was anything but straightforward. Nothing would ever be given. Everything would have to be earned. And he knew it, too. It's a journey that's hard to believe, especially considering that just months prior to the puck dropping on that first season, the Whalers were nothing more than an idea. A dream. At the time, one of Boston's leading sports columnists wrote that the chances of the 20-something-year-old successfully establishing a WHA team in New England were, quote, slim and none. After all, founding a professional hockey franchise requires an arena, players, and money. Howard had none of the three. But he had ambition. He wasn't afraid to dream.
To be accused of being a dreamer really isn't such a bad thing, so long as you're willing to work hard, to persevere. This is the story of what it took to make my dreams come true.
Welcome to Slim and None. I'm Stephen Maggi, and today Howard Baldwin and I will introduce you to Don Regan, who, along with his law school buddy Gary Davidson, co-founded the American Basketball Association, International Volleyball Association, World Team Tennis, World Football League, and of course, the World Hockey Association. Don was the legal genius of the WHA, and as you'll see today, one of the great storytellers in all of hockey. Welcome, Don. You know, when you talk about the WHA, it really starts with you and Gary.
My memory, when I'm thinking about doing this, goes to Dennis Murphy. And, you know, Dennis is the guy that went up and hustled Bill Hunter. As I recall, Bill Hunter had it in for the NHL, and they kept telling him to go, you know, jump off a cliff or do whatever the hell. And so Dennis got that. But he remembered from our World American Basketball Association deal that he, Dennis, wasn't a key executive or the best front man. He was really good. So that's why he brought Gary and me in. It was in February of 1972, and Dennis had a meeting in L.A. or whatever, but he brought Bill Hunter and Ben Hatskin in from Calgary, Scotty Monroe, right. And they were coming in, and neither Gary and I knew the difference between a hockey puck and a frisbee or a watermelon. And so we preliminary called, and they said, well how come you come with us? And I said, well, you guys formed a league, and it's still going, and nobody else knows how to form a league. Okay, thank you very much. So we had set, Gary and I and Dennis set a price that we were going to sell, form the league, set a price, sell some franchises. And we needed these three guys, or they needed us, or so there's a marriage. But so they come down on it. You're in Southern California now. It's a day just like this in February. And we set the meeting at a place called the Balboa Bay Club before it was rebuilt. And they had some boardrooms, small boardrooms that faced the bay. And so we set the table up with the three of us, Dennis and Dick, looking into the wall. And we had the three of them looking out the window at the bay. And being a somewhat imaginative salesman, I got a couple of my friends with pretty big yachts to pull them up and park them right outside that window. And we hired, I think it was four girls. I mean, you know, they were Sports Illustrated swimsuit types, and they were shining the bright work on the boat the whole time we're in the meeting. And so the three of them were going to leave that night, And I think they ended up leaving on Thursday, and we had a signed contract.
Just to be clear, Don, that would have been February 71, correct? Because February 72.
71, I'm sorry, yeah. Yeah, well,
that's a great story.
Good story. And I've, you know, I got a bunch of grown sons and son-in-law now, and they said, what about a great salesman? And I said, well, one of the most amazing human beings I've ever met in my life, God rest his soul in peace, and was John Bassett. And John Bassett always had these great stories about the great salesman. And I said, well, okay, that got us there. But the next thing I remember is that we had a meeting, I want to say it was in Boston, I'm not sure where, but Howard and John, who we looked like we were about 21 or 22, except Dennis was a little older. They looked like they're about 17 and 16. And they come up to this meeting, and as I remember the dialogue, they were going around and saying, hey, these guys are too young and they don't know what they're doing. And so there was not a vape. And so I got a car and went down to Marion, Massachusetts to talk to them. I don't, John, you probably remember this. And I remember one of you guys picked me up and put me in a Citroen and ran the right wheels up on the curb and drove down the street and said, see, this is a really unique car.
That's correct.
And but I could tell that you know, that this was the if Gary and I are out, you know, we're putting this in together, this was going to be this guy's 110% deal. You know, they had their heart in it, and they knew enough guys in Boston. Old West Coaster, I learned a great lesson about how to answer or how to ask questions in New England. Because when I was heading down south towards the bay or Buzzards Bay or wherever it was, I went into a little gas station out in the middle of nowhere, and I said, excuse me, do you know the way to Marion, Massachusetts? And the pause, and the guy says, yep. And think about that. And I said, oh, I said, well, could you tell me the way? And he says, oh. But he said, I said, so we got down there, and I remember, I don't think I ever met Kelly, but I got, or at that time, but I got a sense that Howard and John had really done their homework and that he was going to be a key guy. And I didn't find out till later that he, what he cut you in college and you liked him so much that you, you brought him in to be your hockey man.
I can
relate to that because I played freshman basketball at UCLA and I was the first guy on the next year out for varsity that John Wooden cut. So, and there isn't anybody that's been with Wooden doesn't worship him. So I could really relate to what.
And Don, tell us, because to me, one of the whole keys that made the league work was the fact that your legal analysis of the contract NHL had was so right on the nose. Can you sort of walk us through that?
One of the first things we did, we had a good experience in the World Hockey Association, the ABA, American Basketball Association, but we never really got in to with the fight going on the whole time we were there. And by the time it got going, George Mikan kicked Gary out and me along with him. So we never really got into the basics other than that I looked at the way that NBA was formed, and I said, God, these documents are ridiculous. So I had a couple guys up in Canada, but send me all the player contracts, the NHL Constitution, the Stanley Cup, all that stuff. And I started reading, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. And so I called one of my best friends from law school, who by that time was on his way up at a firm called Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, and he ended up being the head of the trial department there. But I said, hey, John, look at this contract. And at any rate, the player contract for the NHL was okay for this season. But what it said was that I agree to play for the Chicago Bulls, okay, if you will, next year on the same terms as this contract, okay, comma, except for the salary, which will be negotiated later. And as a pure lawyer, I mean, that you've got to have everything definite, certain. And I said, oh, wait a minute. So I put out an opinion, which I still stand by, that we could go ahead and sign any player. We could sign any NHL player who had just that contract. We couldn't sign him to play this year, but we could assign him to play next year because that reserve clause, or whatever you will, was full of it. Okay, so we did, and if I can segue to Bobby Hull, let's discuss Bobby Hull after we get that, because I got those are some unbelievable parts too. So I went to Chicago, and we everywhere that the WHA had signed players, and I'm assuming you did, Howard, in the Whalers, we signed players for next year, and they sued us, but we won everywhere. And L.A. Right. And New York, and so we're in Chicago. We're going to sign, but we didn't have Bobby come to court because we were worried about it. So I'm staying at a place called the Standard Club, which with one of my sons. I always took one of my sons with me because we was traveling so much. Anyway, and we're named Regan. The Standard Club was all Jewish, and we didn't know that at the time. It didn't make any difference. But our law firm that I hired was called Gavard Moskowitz, Danowitz, and Horowitz. And somebody said, why did you hire them? And I said, oh, they're my cousins. And they got in there. I got all sorts of crap about that. But so we're walking from the Standard Club to court, and there's the lawyer and myself and Harvey Weinberg, who ended up being one of my best friends for life. It was Bobby's agent, and he was a CPA and just really savvy guy. And we're walking to court, and I look around, and there's a little guy behind me carrying a briefcase. I said, what are you doing? And they said, well, that's our appellate lawyer. And I said, appellate lawyer? We haven't even been to court yet. And we won in L.A. and New York and Dayton and Houston, you know, everywhere we've been. And they said, no, you don't understand. This is Chicago. And that guy up there we're going to see is their judge. So sure enough, after a whole day in court, the guy said, oh, that you guys are full of what that contract is. So, Bobby, we issued an injunction against Bobby Hull signing. But you have to serve an injunction on a guy personally. And naturally, and we'd kept Bobby away. So what are we going to do? Harvey said that Bobby Hull, and we had $1 million by then. Gary and Howard, you probably had already raised money, and Ben Haskin had it. And he said, but Bobby Hull has to receive that money in the USA for tax purposes. And we said, okay, well, what are we going to do? So I went up to Winnipeg and hired a two-engine plane and a pilot, and Harvey and I and Bobby Hull and Ben Haskin flew into Fargo, North Dakota. And we got off on the tarmac, signed Bobby Hull on the tarmac, gave him his $1 million, hopped on the plane, went back to Winnipeg, and then flew into Chicago. And as we landed in Chicago and came off the plane, their lawyers and all the people were waiting with process servers. And I got off the plane and gave them the Irish good luck sign with just one digit. And so they were really frustrated. And so, okay, so a whole lot of things happened, Bobby Hull. But fast forward on the legal track. So what happened is my buddy from Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher in L.A. said there is a guy in Philadelphia who's a sole practitioner, and he likes to take on the Giants, and all he does is antitrust law, and he is really, really good. And so you ought to go talk to him. So I did. So he said, and he agreed. And so he said, instead of them suing us all over the place, let's the WHA, sue the NHL to get an injunction against them from trying to enforce this contract. And so we had we went to Philadelphia, and this guy going, he was amazing. My job as a relatively young lawyer at a big law firm had been, you know, to carry the briefcases for the big hitters. So I'm carrying the briefcase in, and it's just the two of us. And the NHL had a firm on the other side called Covington and Burling, and they did as bad a job as any firm I've ever seen at this time. And so tomorrow morning when we started, in comes Edward Bennett Williams. And if you guys know, you know, then the legal giant in the entire world. And so, and we had this great big old judge, Leon Higginbotham. I still remember. Great. That's super guy. Great, yeah. Big, huge guy. Looks like he played linebacker or offensive tackle or whatever. And he said, no nonsense. We start at 9 o'clock, and you guys, I've got big cases waiting you guys. So Edward Bennett Williams comes in and takes over the case from the other guys, and they're sitting there. And the first thing that was said, he jumps up And he says, Your Honor, I haven't had time to read the transcript or get familiar with the facts. And so I hadn't said anything all day yesterday. So I jumped up and I said, Your Honor, if Mr. Williams hadn't had time to read the transcript or get familiar with the facts, maybe he shouldn't say anything until he does. And the judge laughed all over the place and made Williams sit down. And the end result of which, I had at that time, I was had one of my daughters with well, my one, my daughter with me, who was about 10. And Williams came out and pounded me on the back, and he said, "That's a good one, kid." And who's this? And I told my wife. So he got his secretary and his chauffeur to take her all around for the next 2 days all over Philadelphia while we were in court. And then Higginbotham issued the injunction that we wanted. So from then on, they were still suing us. You know, they were bigger. But so
the Higginbotham decision was written almost like a movie script. It was legal, well, but it was also just so brilliantly factually written. I have a copy of it right here. It's just a fascinating opinion.
Well, you're talking to who wrote most of it. So.
Well, then, good for you. Congratulations.
That opinion enabled us to sign us, the WHA, to sign NHL players for next year. So Howard, and you know, you guys went out, you're on the firing line. I'm just a lowly lawyer in the background here. But this is one of the few, one of the gazillion stories I'll tell you about Bobby Hull. But one of the most amazing things, and I mentioned before, I've been in, you know, I played sports in college. I was the captain of an NCAA team, and in volleyball, and I made All-American, and I was a lawyer for our Olympic team for a couple of years, and so I had played beach volleyball, but that's all way background, because I've known a lot of sports guys, including Wilt Chamberlain. We were partners for a long time, and Tom Fears, if you remember, and other guys, but I've never met anybody that was more of a grateful human being as to what, how come and what was happening, how it was happening to him. And I don't think he fought too hard with all the girls that were chasing him around. But anyway, the first game in New York, we opened in Madison Square Garden, and the decision by the Chicago guys was that they weren't going to play Bobby that game. They were just going to have him walk around behind the bench in a coat and tie like a coach. I said, okay. At the end of the first period, I'm sitting down there, and you guys have been to Madison Square Garden, you know, way up and straight. This little kid comes walking down, and he was the kind that as a father, he was 10 or 11 years old, big fat kid, could barely, with glasses the size of Coke bottles, and he had his autograph thing in his hand, and he makes it all the way down to the bench just as the period is over, and he's right behind the bench, and he's going to hold this thing up to Bobby Hull, and the usher, policeman, whatever, grabs the kid and says, get back, you know, sends the kid all the way back up to the top. So teams go in, they come out for the second period. Before it starts, Bobby grabs the cop or the usher, sends him all the way up to the top, brings the kid down and sits him on the bench with him.
Wow.
And I mean,
that's a great story.
That's a great story. And he got a standing ovation, and nobody could figure in the stands what the hell's happening. Everybody in the whole side of the arena is standing up, yelling and screaming and whistling, and it was really amazing. And then the other legal part I did was not across the league, but is in Quebec. I starting the Quebec Nordiques, none of us were familiar with the Napoleonic code that works in Quebec City, and so I had to go in there and we really wanted a team, and we couldn't get one in Montreal, but we really wanted a team in French Canada, and so that was my New England. They gave me the lowest of the low to pursue New Hartford, New England Whalers, and you know, and et cetera. No, seriously. So I go into Chicago, and then I'm going to fly to Quebec. And they said, so Quebec then airport wasn't big enough to take a jet. So we came in at the DC-3, and we, we land, and a guy named Paul Racine, Howard, you probably remember him, and he picks me up in a Rolls Royce. We're driving from Quebec into, and he's telling me in all the places that they ended up, next time around, they brought Gary and me up and took us fishing where they said where Roosevelt and Churchill went fishing and everything. But as we're driving into Quebec, there isn't anything there but a bunch of farmland and cattle and cranberries or whatever the hell. And we sort of stop, and there's a 12-story office building sort of in the edge of town. And he says, Monsieur Regan. I said, yeah. He says, my brother and I built that office building. And we said, oh, I said, that's Paul. I said, that's interesting, comma, without a mortgage. So we said, okay. So he took us, put us up at the Chateau Frontenac. With all the French lawyers, we said, fine. We signed the deal, whatever they needed. And I brought my wife too that time. But anyway, we ended up being friends with the Racine family for 3 or 4 years. When their oldest daughter got married, they had the Cardinal of all of Canada perform and two bands and ice sculptures with Dom Perignon magnums in the middle of them. And Sarah, my wife, danced the night away with Paul Racine. And then the way we formed the league is that the inside guys would take a franchise and try and finance it and get the big people that come. And that was one of the things that I was most buoyant about Howard and John, because they were really, you know, I think they had a bucket to you know what in, but not much. But they were going to get the guys that were going to be able to make the decision, and so Howard did that, and so I was handsomely rewarded and turned the franchise over to him, and we eventually had an all-star game there, but that's the big thing. The legal side was how badly the NHL. Had done their infrastructure, and then the second part of it is they did their marketing arm. They had a big deal in Hockey Night in Canada, but they didn't have much else, and they wouldn't let anybody, like, which is one of the genesis of the WHA, which the NHL wouldn't let anybody into Hockey Night in Canada. And so we formed, in addition to the league, we formed a separate entity, which WHA Properties, which in order to be a partner in WHA Properties, you had to own a team in the WHA. And one of the great moves we made is keeping all of the coaches and the hockey general managers out of the marketing deal and just let the marketing guys do it. And we had a guy named Max Mulliman. He went to work in Canada and gave us the credibility. We had, 15 or 20 league-wide marketing contracts before we dropped the puck. And one of them, and eventually in the first year, he put together the ABCO Cup. And ABCO gave us a whole bunch of money. But what that did is gave us credibility in the marketing place, so that in addition to what you could get in the sports page and you know, everybody wants to come pick you up in a limousine. But if we come in and said, well, I'm going to build a cement factory and employ 10,000 people, they'd say, yeah, see you later. But so we did that. And Howard knows, and you're going to, you know, we had arguments over who got the front page or the inside page of the program. And there wasn't any TV revenue at the extent we have later. I consider that a real part of the legal, quote unquote, package, and package is a good letter, because our league, the WHA, in my not so humble opinion, was really well formed, and the structure was of substance. Witness the fact that Higginbotham saw it, and lots of other leagues since then have copied it.
What were they like to compete against? Because there's an arrogance that comes from the NHL in those days where, hey, we're the traditional thing. Yeah. We don't have to do anything. Did that kind of inspire you to, like, kind of, because it looks like you were having fun doing this to them.
Well, I wasn't as much on the front line here that Howard and the other guys were. But the lawyer in Toronto that was the lawyer for the NHL Players Association, Alan Eagles. Eagle, you got it.
Yeah, Alan Eagles.
I called him, and I thought, well, you know, hey, the best thing that ever happened to for the players. Let's have another league. So now you're making $10 an hour, and now you're going to make $30 an hour, and we're going to bid back and forth. He wouldn't even talk to me. And because he saw us, at us, the WHA, as a threat to his position of power in the NHL Players Association, instead of being our great supporter with a couple of guys, Sanderson, I think, and somebody. We had to fight him instead of having him cooperate to have us sign players. And, Howard, you probably had to tangle with him one time or another.
We actually, I think the first player that signed with the WHA was a guy we had, Danny Arndt, I'm pretty sure. He was definitely in cahoots. He was kidding who. It was a pretty incestuous relationship they had at that time. Huh. I mean, I actually went on and became and grew to respect Alan and like him, though he's somewhat controversial. I certainly, my dealings with him were just fine. But he certainly did have, he was controversial.
In terms of getting into this whole thing, obviously you looked at it and realized, hey, what they were trying to do from a legal standpoint, you could beat what you did. Was the other thing the fact that it was coming off the big success of the AFL and, you know, in football? And you can see, like, if you do it right, there is something at the end of the rainbow.
The answer is yes, and we're not talking ABA here, but it was where Gary and I broke our maiden. You know, we came out. Nobody else had ever started a league like we were doing, but it came from the ABA came from a failed attempt. Three guys in Southern California and Orange County in LA, Bill Sharman, and who was with the Lakers and one of the great players at USC ever, and two guys from Orange County had some money raised to get an AFL franchise and start signing AFL players against the NFL and build a stadium in Anaheim and et cetera, et cetera. And so the NFL, being smarter than some of the other guys, they went straight to Al Davis and said, okay, let's merge. And so Al Davis sold out. So these guys had the money raised and no league to start. And that's how the ABA started. Our key guy there was there were several key guys, but at any rate, we got the owner of the Harlem Globetrotters to be our lead. But in so doing, I had the benefit. I had two young guys, Howard, you probably know, Tim Grandy and Alan White, who were really, really smart, working for me, and they were both, jocks and played. So this isn't a hard sell. Everybody in the world wants to, get involved in that. But we took a blank piece of paper. We took every we had a conference table as long as from here to there when we started the WHA. Now we are, and we lined up all these other league documents and threw half of them away, and we had a blank sheet of paper, and that's how the WHA and WHA properties evolved, and it was much better than we did in the NBA. And then Howard was around with this when the WFL and Howard, proving Howard and John, and I'm not sure who all the other guys they had, but didn't you bring Schmertz in to the Whalers too?
Oh yeah.
Schmertz was the head of the president of the Celtics, and we had pictures of him pouring champagne on his hair and in the locker room, and he was a key. And I don't know when he got sick and died and his two wives started fighting, that ruined a lot of our plans.
That's sort of right. I mean, he came in December of 71 when we got the franchise in November, and we got him in by mid-December. We got him in very quickly.
Yeah.
He got the Celtics towards the end of the first year of the Whalers and then tragically died. About 2 years after he got the Celtics. And his widow is actually still a very good friend of ours, very good friend.
But what we didn't have that the AFL had, is we didn't have a Baron Hilton or and a Lamar Hunt. You know, we didn't have any huge, it could happen, guys. We had a lot of people like Howard that were putting together and bringing the best man in. And segue, one of the things, I worked for various AFL entities babysitting players. And when this is 3 years or before that, before all this, but they would go out and sign, you know, I remember tackle, but they would go out and draft so-and-so, and then they'd send one of us to get him, and I'd take him to Hawaii for 3 or 4 days so the NHL couldn't find him. And so when I went to a meeting and they were going to have a game between Houston and L.A. at the L.A. Coliseum, and they'd figured there was going to be about 4,000 or 5,000 people there. And so I got shouted down, but I said one of the great PR things you could ever do is have the game, sell no tickets, have Lamar sit on one side and Baron Hilton on the other side. There's two guys in the game going on. I said that would make sports history, and nobody bought that idea.
One other question I want to ask you guys both. It seems like your league has had feel to them, and that went into like the logos, right? I mean, you think of the WHA, and even in the basketball side, the ABA, people fondly remember that. Was that part of it? It was like, we're gonna actually make marketing a part of this. We're not going to just go out there and put the thing out because the sport's great. You know, we're going to go out and we're going to actually market it?
100%. When again, this guy Max Mulliman, who's a year younger than I mean, he's in his 80s too. But he was, the marketing rep for Goodyear tires, and he talked into putting logos on race car hoods at Indy 500, and Dan Gurney, you know, when Dan Gurney racers, All American racers, and he was out here working with All American racers, and we saw what he was doing, His wife, his mother-in-law, lived in the desert around the corner from my sister. So I went out and we talked Max into joining us. And his enthusiasm is infectious. And he knew all of the marketing at that time, pre-big TV. But so I don't know if Howard, if he had it when he introduced him, but he had a quick wit too. But part of our package was, is that you're going to make so much money, attendance and whatever, but we got to build what I've called enterprise value in the WHA as a going entity. And the way we establish the validity and the long that the sports writers that are in the NHL's pocket can't do anything about is we have a really good marketing program. And so those logos, Max knows who, but somebody was an artist. You did your own, Howard. But you had to present your logo to a internal jury, and
yeah, the logos were all great.
Oh, yeah. Can I do a couple more on Bobby Hull?
Sure.
When we were trying to sign him, I went up to Winnipeg, and I stayed at his house actually, and I'd get up in the morning, and he went out last night and got a hose out and it froze overnight so that the driveway was frozen. And so my job in the morning was to get up and put some pads on and play goalie against the garage door against Bobby and Brett. We were, you know, 6 or 7, you know, or 8 years old. And Bobby used to stand there and laugh. And he said, well, maybe you could do it. And laugh. And he said, but, you know, what's a good goalie in the NHL? And I said, no, Bobby. And he says, well, a good goalie with any balls doesn't have any teeth, so you better watch out. So fast forward, when the ABA had a team in San Diego called the Conquistadors, and Wilt Chamberlain is the coach down there, and they had a party that they were going to bring a hockey team into San Diego to share the arena with, and it was going to, and I think it eventually happened, and Howard, it wasn't ever part of the WHA, but I think it happened in a minor league, and the featured speaker was Bobby Hull, and I was in San Diego at the time, and I heard about this, and so there's a lunch going on, so there's a big you know, auditorium in a hotel or, you know, banquet room or whatever you will. So I open the door at the back, and I come walking in, and you know, all the lights are shining on the podium up in front, and I sort of sidle over to the side, and Bobby stopped in the middle of his talk, and he said, "Hey, I just want to say thank you to the guy that spent a month working with me and getting me in and getting that from with Joanne and myself and da-da." And he just walked in the back door. "Say hi, Don." And that's the kind of Bobby. And I hadn't talked to him in months.
No, he's a great guy.
I wish if Gary was good for 10 minutes and I'm good for 20, if John Bassett were still alive, he could go on and on. He was such a phenomenal guy, and he was the biggest deep pocket.
Thanks, Don, for joining us today and sharing your memories of the World Hockey Association. We hope to have you on again as the series continues. Well, Howard, season one is over, and we're almost ready to play hockey. How were you feeling at the time? Were you had to be completely excited, and you never knew day to day what was going to turn up?
Well, I mean, we were building up to the what I call grand opening, and I think that our season one here that we've had together with our 13 episodes sets the table beautifully for what we're going to do next year. And next year we're going to pick up right where we left off, right with the opening game in the Boston Garden, and then down to Philadelphia where the Zamboni goes through the ice and get into an exciting second season.
I think it'll be really exciting not only to see the development of the Whalers in the championship season, but also take a look at the league because there were some big successes and there were some teams that didn't do as well.
100% right. And I think what we'll do, of course, we'll talk Whalers, and I think we'll, not think, I know, we'll get right into the nitty-gritty of the move to Hartford, which really happened really a third of the way through the second season. And I want to get into that, and then I want to talk about how we were getting ready to take Cincinnati in and Phoenix in and Indianapolis in, which I think will interest people. And then, of course, the great signing of the house. So I think the second season is going to be really exciting. We're going to have terrific guests, high-profile guests, and some great stories that I can promise you this have not been heard before.
Certainly, if the signings of the Howes are anything like the signing of Bobby Hull, it has to be a fascinating thing. And again, another key step to claiming complete legitimacy in the battle against the NHL.
That's right. And we forget, if you think of some of the greatest names in hockey, at that point in time, it was really Hull and it was Howe and, of course, Bobby Orr. And then you get a guy like Rocket Richard. Well, the Rocket actually coached in Quebec the first year for a little while. So, you know, the WHA proved early on it could attract some pretty big names and as well as some exciting young names.
And then finally, it had to be great for a lot of the players that wouldn't even have been in the top pro league had it not been for the opportunity the WHA led to, which are stars that maybe we wouldn't even know about had the WHA not existed.
I think the WHA, without question, it gave players that weren't getting that opportunity in the NHL. I mean, one of our guests next year is going to be Andre Lacroix. He's a great example. He just wasn't quite, he was playing in the NHL, but he wasn't starring in the NHL, and he got a chance to come over to the WHA and really star. One of the great, great players. He should be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, he's unbelievable, and he showed he could play in any league because he got a chance in the WHA and a fantastic guy. So, yeah, the WHA gave a lot of cities, a lot of markets, and a lot of players opportunity.
We can't wait. That'll be next season, season two, coming up shortly, and we're going to drop the puck for the first time in the World Hockey Association.
We can't wait. Look forward to it. Have a good summer, and we'll talk in a couple of months.
The league is ready to go. Franchises like the Whalers are prepared to compete not only against the other teams in the league, but in the local sports markets as well. For other teams, mere survival is the challenge. Howard and I will address it all next season on Slim and None. For Howard Baldwin, this is Stephen Maggi. Thank you for listening.